Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And welcome to another edition of More Outdoors. For those of you who have successfully located us at 105.3 WWL FM HD2. Yeah, it's a mouthful, but it's really easy to find if you happen to be listening on an HD radio. But when you don't have an HD radio nearby and you want to listen to us, you can use a desktop, laptop, iPhone, smartphone, iPad, and just look on the you can go to my webpage again and use the Listen Live, but you can also go to WWL's website and find it there. It's easy enough to locate it and get a good, clear, crisp signal through. I know this week I was telling Doug, our engineer, that I traveled to Alabama and had it on, and we were around, I think I was around Wool Market, which is on the other side of Gulfport, Biloxi, before I finally lost the signal. So we can reach out and include some Mississippi Gulf Coast listeners and, of course, the entire metro New Orleans area. So thanks for tuning us in. Got interesting programs for you on More Outdoors, 8 to 9 o'clock hour. It's Hunt Fish Talk, our regular monthly roundtable discussion with other outdoor writers, Lyle Johnson, Wendy, the Bayou Woman Billiot, and Keith Lusher, the host of the North Shore Fishing Report, will join me to talk about two burning issues in Louisiana, that ongoing red snapper saga, and also the now high-profile public versus private waterways issue. Daryl Carpenter filed a 36-page lawsuit, which is probably going to have some impact on precedent as far as what is designated open to the public and what is private when it comes to wetlands. Pretty easy to decide on hard ground, but wetlands and open waters and bays, a whole different ball game there. We'll talk about that in the 8 to 9 o'clock hour. This to 7 to 8. Special time change for Talking Guns. We are joined by our regular hosts, Devin Burgess and Gavin Sashery, and we've got a lot to talk about. A gun product. We'll be hearing an interview from Jesse. We'll be hearing that later in the program. We're also going to talk about those Class 3 devices, which include silencers and full auto firearms. There's some possibly new laws that are being introduced or pertaining to the over-the-counter purchase, which has been really a difficult process on silencers in the past. And also a question that comes up very, very often about the restrictions in the language in our concealed carry permit about carrying a firearm at a parade. Does it pertain to the people in the parade, the spectators at the parade? Can or can you not carry your concealed weapon with a permit at a parade? We'll discuss all of those things and, of course, your calls and questions. You can call us at 504-260-6368. Unfortunately, the popular text board is inoperable this morning. I'm lost. I can't get my texts that normally come in from all of our listeners, but keep trying. Sooner or later, it's going to break, and I'll be inundated with them. So let me welcome in our co-hosts, Devin Burgess and Gavin Sashery. And, Gavin, you know, you were telling me earlier that the good thing about doing this by remote location is you don't have to see Devin's early morning face on a Saturday. So I don't know, Devin, that was kind of cold, you know?
It very is, low. But it's not the same as since he cut his ponytail.
Oh, boy. He doesn't have to put his makeup on either when he doesn't come in the studio. So that's good news. Well, guys, good to have you all with us. I was kind of, you know, teasing what we're going to be talking about. And I guess the first thing to talk about is this issue of silencers. And Devin, since you're in the business of selling in the retail store at the Jefferson Gun Outlet, maybe you might want to update us on what has been the procedure in order to be the owner of a silencer, and that actually extends into short barrel rifles and full auto firearms, which are really prevented from public purchase in the past, and what the new law may change with regard to that.
Of course, Devin with the face for radio. Take it away. Congratulations, by the way, before we start. You got a new radio station, a new FN, you know, high definition moving up.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, You're deserving of it, you know. You certainly have earned it.
I do my best. All right, so in the past, it's very confusing to our customers as well, so hopefully this bill passes. It'd be a great step forward in the right direction for where we want to go. But anyway, in the past, if you wanted to buy a Class 3 device, which is a full auto machine gun, a silencer, a short barrel rifle, a short barrel shotgun, things like that, all those items were grouped together in what we call Class 3 NFA items. So you would come into the store, and if we owned it, meaning a store, you would come in, you would purchase that item, and then it would sit in our safe for 9 or 10 months until your paperwork that I file through the store and the ATF came back approved for you to legally possess those items. So to get that, there was two ways of doing so. There was doing it as an individual, which there was actually a law passed last year that allowed individuals to come into our store with nothing but Louisiana ID and U.S. citizenship and in time legally obtain a suppressor or a short barrel rifle. And before that, it's a little confusing, so stay with me here. So before the law was passed that you could file as an individual to obtain a Class 3 weapon or silencer or full auto, you would have to go to an attorney and get what's called a revocable NFA trust, which is, in essence, incorporating yourself under a trust. So when you applied for those devices, the trust would own it. It wouldn't really be owned by you. You were on the trust or you would own the trust, but the trust itself would own the item because before that it was not legal for you to own those items. So the trust would. So hopefully, it's only a small step, but hopefully soon they will pass a law that will take suppressors or silencers off of that Class 3 device list. So instead of being short barrel rifles, machine guns, short barrel shotguns, and suppressors or silencers will then be taken off of the NFA Class 3 list. And all you would have to do is come in, and just like you would buy a regular handgun or long gun, you'd fill out a background check and most likely leave with that item the same day. So the bill itself amends the Internal Revenue Code to eliminate the $200 transfer tax, which is what everybody has to pay to acquire a Class 3 device and a silencer, since as of right now, that's a Class 3 device. And it also will treat any person who acquires or possesses a firearm silencer as meeting any registration or licensing requirements of the National Firearms Act. So you won't need to go through that NFA paperwork anymore. Also, if you've already paid your transfer tax, that $200 tax, so if you've already paid that, after October 22nd of 2015, you'll receive a refund, which is pretty cool too. So as of right now, what we're telling all of our customers is even if you're not sure if this law is going to pass, just like I'm not sure if it will, every now and then they try to do this, and it hasn't worked yet. But if you're on the fence about it, you can come in. You can buy your suppressor before they all run out. And even if it doesn't pass, you'll have one in the workings. You know, you'll receive it in 8 or 9 months. But if it does pass, you're going to get your money back that you paid anyway, that extra $200. You're going to get that back, and you'll be ahead of the game. You already have a suppressor waiting for you in our safe. Because trust me, if it passes, going to be very hard to find a silencer, you know, for a few months, I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, you did an excellent job on explaining that, Devin. Congratulations on a very complex issue. No, seriously. But let me ask you this. I have test fired suppressors on long guns. I've never done it on either a shotgun or a handgun, but I've never found one that is like in the movies where it's just a You don't hear anything at all. There's quite a bit of noise comes from it, even with a suppressor on it. Are there any on the market that act like those ones James Bond uses?
There's one, and it's not just the suppressor that comes into play. So really what's loud with smaller calibers is not only the explosion of, you know, the bullet when it goes off, but it's also the bullet when it breaks the sound barrier. That's also right. Very, very loud. That sonic crack that you get at the front of the muzzle is very loud when that bullet breaks the sound barrier. So if you have a suppressor that can shoot a 22 long rifle, that's, you know, capable of firing 22 long rifle, and you buy a subsonic 22 long rifle bullet, that's about as quiet as you're going to get, but it's not like the movie.
Still noisy.
Yeah.
It's still a little noisy, but it's like the quietest one I've found is like you know those Benjamin pump pellet guns?
Uh-huh.
You know, it sounds like that.
Yeah. Well, I've never heard one that quiet.
Not,
yeah, right.
You know, it's not
really
like
silence. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's not.
Great job,
Deb. All quiet.
And it would suffice to say, anybody that has questions about the purchase or the equipment itself, stop by or give Devin a call there at the Jefferson Gun Outlet. All right, we're going to take a break. We come back. Gavin, going to be your turn. I want you to explain, since you are a concealed carry permit instructor, this kind of a controversial line that's in the permitting regulations about parades, who can carry concealed weapons at parades. And maybe we'll get a straight answer. All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to Talking Guns, and we are on 105.3 WWL FM HD2. You can hear us worldwide on the Internet, or you can tune it in on your HD radio one click beyond the normal 105.3, and you'll hear the lovely tones of Devin Burgess, Gavin Sasher, and me, Don Dubuque. We'll be right back. And unfortunately, if you send me a text, I won't get it, at least not immediately, but hopefully at some point our text message board will break free and I'll get that. Otherwise, call us 504-260-1350 or 260-6368 will work. Devin Burgess and Gavin Sasher are standing by to take your calls. Gavin, it's your turn. With regard to concealed carry permits, you are a trained instructor at the Shooters Club Indoor Range and Training Center. People go to see you, take your class, get their concealed carry permits, and other forms of training. If I were to go to a parade, and there's not much danger of that because I usually go the other way when I see a parade. But if I were going to get backed up in traffic and have a hard time finding a place to go to the bathroom, and likely get my feet stomped on by somebody trying to get a pair of beads or something else, I really would like to carry my concealed firearm with me to a parade. Would I be legal in doing so? There's been some controversy about the language of the regulations pertaining to concealed carry permits. What is the real deal on carrying firearms at or in parades?
I'm going to tell you it's a no. I always tell people it's a no. There's a lot of wishful thinking that goes on there. But if you look at state law, which is 1495, LARS 1495, it tells you you should not be within 1,000 feet of a parade or anything where they get a permit for gathering and participation, any kind of big activity like that. Down here, your biggest thing is a parade. State law says 1,000 feet. You also have to deal with the fact that anytime they have a parade or like today they have that family grow thing out in Jefferson Parish, every parish around here has a municipal ordinance that kicks in, and they say within 1,000 feet of what they call a special event, they put up a firearm-free zone. And it's also 1,000 feet. So you can skate one and maybe not the other. It's a lot of wishful thinking. From instructors, I should say, it comes from a meeting the state police had with everybody back in, like, 2010. And the trooper that was in charge of the section back then said he wouldn't have a problem with you telling people that if you were just there viewing the parade, you weren't participating. If you were riding in a parade, you were. But that was his opinion. He's not a lawyer or the attorney general or anything like that. And unless it's changed, I would tell people it's a no. You said about stopping to use the bathroom or driving in the car. You're not supposed to be within 1,000 feet of parade with that firearm unless you're engaged in what this state calls a constitutionally protected activity, meaning your house is on a parade route, you're in your house or on your property, inside your car, inside your business, something like that. stopping just on a parade route to use the bathroom would probably be a problem in and of itself, although I don't know who would notice. But as far as carrying the gun, I would say it's a no. Plenty of people would say yes, but I had a guy from the top prosecuting agency in this area finally do that lawyer dance and say, no, I would consider you participating if you were just watching that parade. Mm-hmm. So I err on the side of caution, and I always do, and I just tell people I would rather see you not bring it and not get in trouble, because in the end, you may beat the court case, but you won't be getting arrested. It's all dependent on who responds to and where you are.
Mm-hmm. All right. To your knowledge, has it ever been challenged in court?
That part I don't know. People get arrested on the parade route with them all the time. I can tell you, it's opposite around here of what you would think. Orleans Parish is very, very tolerant. They're more than likely to ask you just to go back and put it in the car, your hotel room, and come back and have a good time. Out in Jefferson Parish, I can't speak for others, but in Jefferson, they pretty much operate on a zero tolerance policy. You know, if they catch you with a gun later today at Family Graw, I'm sorry, I'm getting confused with my Graws, you're probably going to jail. They probably won't give you any kind of leeway or anything else. They just take it very seriously.
All right, this question might be splitting hairs. Let's say okay. I have my truck parked, attached with a trailer on a parade route, which a lot of people do, maybe not so much in New Orleans, it's not allowed, or even Jefferson. I think it does still go on in neutral grounds in Jefferson, and certainly it goes on in St. Tammany Parish. Can I keep my firearm in my vehicle while I'm at a parade?
Yes,
if it stays in the vehicle.
If it stays in that vehicle, yes, because then you're engaged in what Louisiana considers a constitutionally protected activity. And as long as it stays in the vehicle, you can be it can be inches away from the float. It's when you get out of that vehicle with it on your person, that it's going to start to become a problem.
So the vehicle pretty much trumps all other preventative regulations. If it's in the vehicle, that would trump any other law that would supersede it from being in a particular place.
To me, yes. Unless you happen to park like at the parking lot of the federal building and they tell you no or something like that.
Yeah. All right. I had another question, too. You mentioned any event that requires permitting. So we're not really just talking about parades. What about, like, protests? You know, these protests that are starting being organized and people that are required to get a permit to do that. Would that also be a place where a concealed carry would not be allowed, even if you permitted?
To me, yes. And it's not just going to be concealed carry. It's going to be having a firearm in general. I'm going to say yes, because they're supposed to get a permit for that. Supposed to. Do they always, you know, as well as I do, no, they don't. They just get started up. But technically, if you want to read the law, I would say yes. I would say yes, but it's a no, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I don't know. It gets pretty sticky on some of these issues, and I'm sure a lot of them would be court-tested and might even have differing results depending on where you are and what the circumstances might be. All right, with regard to open carry, which is allowed in Louisiana, is that prevented in parades, at parades, or other events that require permitting?
If you read the statute, yeah, it doesn't really designate between concealed or open. It just says, you know, it's illegal to carry a firearm at any time within 1,000 feet of parade, et cetera, et cetera.
Got it. Well, Gavin, while we're talking about training and permits, if you would, for people, and I know every day people tell me and they ask questions about getting a concealed carry permit and carrying firearms, explain to them what goes into acquiring a permit in the state of Louisiana.
In Louisiana, you have to take a class. The class is a nine-hour mandate by the state. So some of these guys or some of these people, they're going to gun shows, et cetera, and they find somebody who does it for $50 in 4 hours. They're taking an illegal class. Is it a big deal? Yes and no. To those of us that do it the right way, yes. And if the state ever finds out, they'll pull your permit. But you have to take a nine-hour class. And submit, once you get a certificate from that class, submit that certificate and application and some other paperwork. You know, if you've ever divorced and arrested in the military, et cetera, et cetera. You submit all that to the state of Louisiana, and they read it, I think. at this point right now, since it's we run at about a 6-month backlog, who knows anymore? But they read it and they make a decision on whether or not to issue the permit or not issue the permit. Louisiana is a shell issue state, so they're pretty liberal with their interpretation of everything. You know, as long as you can explain to them what happened in your background, they're pretty good about issuing you a permit.
Fingerprinting and photography, what's required there?
All right. For a first-time permit, you do need a set of two FBI fingerprint cards. I'm having trouble this morning. So you need a set of fingerprints. You no longer need a photo. They're going to pull your driver's license photo and use that on your permit. You also need to give them any arrest records, divorce records that you have, anything in your background like that. If you were in the military, you need to give them a copy of your DD-214. There's an added benefit there with an honorable discharge, either from the guard, any type of guard or any type of reserves, et cetera. Your fee to the state for that permit is now free.
Wait a minute. If you say free?
Free, yeah. You don't pay the state anything. Like in the past, like Devin would just pay $125 to the state for a 5-year permit. Now, if he has an honorable discharge, you send your DD-214 in, which you had to do anyway, but your fee to the state is now free since August.
All right, so what about someone like me that has a DD-214 with an honorable discharge, but I've already got my concealed carry permit? Will I not have to pay it on the next renewal?
The next renewal, you're free to the state. Your fee to the state is free.
Okay, only have to pay for my refresher course then.
Only have to pay for the refresher course. And people that have been doing it since August, even some people that turned it in before August, the state has been sending their check back. Call them and see if they'll send you a check back. Probably had a chance of that. But.
Well, from what I heard from Governor Edwards about the situation with the budget, I doubt that they're going to be sending me a check. I'll just be happy to get a free one on the next go-round. Well, if you would tell us about the backlog, 6 months. Is there that long of a wait before you actually get your permit once all your paperwork's been sent?
I'm going to say yes. And we hear people all the time. And they come in about, you know, I brought mine up there and I got it back in 2 weeks. I don't know anybody that's ever gotten it in 2 weeks. I know people keep saying that, but since the beginning of time, I don't know anybody that it's gone that fast. I would plan on it taking 6 months, no matter how I submitted it to them, whether it was online, brought it up there, mailed it in. You know, in a normal situation, they've always said 120 days. So 6 months isn't really that out of the question. It is to people that want it, but I question that, too, because if you take that course and you think you should carry that gun the next day, you have a problem. You need to have another plan except having that gun. You know, the gun is your last resort. And people plan in reverse with this. But I've heard that too many times. There's a 12,000 to 14,000-person backlog right now, and I think they're down to 2 people in an office thanks to budget cuts. They're going as fast as they can.
Just to kind of close out the discussion on carry permits, any progress or more word on the proposed law to allow all states to accept concealed carry permits on a reciprocal basis?
You know, I haven't kept up with where that's going. I know it's moving really slow through Congress. I really don't want to see that because you're giving the federal government an in where they shouldn't have a finger in the pie, to me. And no matter what you do, you will never be able to take that Louisiana permit to California and carry that pistol. You'll never go to New York City and carry that pistol. Any place that's forced to accept it is also going to pass legislation at a local level, restricting it so bad you won't even be able to have the gun with you or something else. So I don't think it helps. I think I'm opposite of a lot of people. I think it could hurt because you don't need them forcing the issue.
Yeah. I also have some questions about, you know, like we have this stipulation on the parades and the permitted events thing. You just go into a state several states away. You don't know what their specific laws are. And if you want to apply the restrictions that you get from your state in another state, you could be in trouble.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. You want to go. I would go to LSP.org, which is the state police's website, click on that map that they print, and whatever state I was going to, I would click on and know their laws. The biggest one around here is that in Louisiana we get really spoiled because you can have that gun anywhere you want in that vehicle. It can be in a bag, box, under the seat, et cetera, et cetera. we think it's like that everywhere. Once you cross out of Louisiana and you're in most other states, it doesn't matter a permit or not. Once you get in that car with a handgun, usually you are transporting it and not carrying it. That permit will cover you while you're carrying a gun on your person out in public, but getting in the vehicle is something totally different. You better really know your rules for transport, you know, whether you got to have it locked in a separate container, all that stuff, before you go somewhere else. That's a really, really huge deal to other states, depending on where you are.
I strongly suggest that to people. If you're going to be traveling by vehicle across several states, check on each one so that you'll know you're within the law with pertaining to what their regulations are, not what you're used to here in Louisiana. All right, guys, stay with me. We got a break coming up. We'll come back and want to hear about our gun product of the month. We got a special interview. I guess that was Devin out there, our roving reporter, cornered somebody again at the SHOT Show and should have an interesting information dissemination. Coming up right after this, you're listening to Talking Guns, and we are on 105.3 WWL FM HD2 Radio. And our text 87870 is temporarily disabled, so you'll have to do the old telephone thing, 504-260-6368. Gavin, before we turn this show over to Devin, wrapping up on the concealed carry, if you would, tell us the schedule of classes over at the Shooters Club Indoor Range where you train.
The schedule is this. Every Saturday, we do that permit class. It starts at 11 o'clock. You just need to be there by 10:30 to make sure you got a spot. We don't take reservations in advance. I can also do that class, and it runs till 8 o'clock. I can also do that class on another day if you have a group of people, you know, that can't make it on a Saturday or just another day either. You just got to call Shooters Club and talk to me, and we'll work something out. I also do renewals on a Saturday morning. We start at 10 o'clock. We do a renewal class, and once again, if you got to do it during the week because Saturday's not good, call Shooters Club and ask for me, and we'll work something out. We do more than most people, so.
Yeah, that's a good range of times and location is at 2338 Hickory Avenue in Harahan. And the telephone number they can call you?
733-1295, and just click on Shooters Club.
All right, very good. Devin, your turn, my friend. I know you've been waiting to tell us about this interview you had with Explora. Tell us about our gun products of the month.
Been patiently waiting over here. Explode. All right, so we went, as many of you know, we went to SHOT. I talked to a bunch of great people, saw a bunch of cool stuff, and every year we see Jesse, the sales rep from Explore. Explore is a company made that makes all kinds of gun bags and carrying cases. They even started making magazine pouches that you know, you can put on chest rigs, long gun cases, range bags, and we chose to carry Explore over some of the other bags because for the price, you get a really nice bag. They go from single to double stitched. They got a bunch of different colors, you know, camo, ACU, black, brown, tan, green. Great people to talk to if, you know, if we ever get an order that isn't right, or if a bag, you know, if somebody uses it a lot and it tears, they'll swap it out for you. Great people to talk to, great customer service. So, yeah, let's listen to me and Jesse talk about Explore Bags.
Devin Burgess again here with Mr. Jesse Brand from Explorer. How you doing, Jesse?
Doing good, Devin. How are you, sir?
I'm good. So we sell an incredible number of your bags in not only our ranges, but our gun store, Jefferson Gun Outlet, the Shooters Club, and Jefferson Indoor Range.
Hello to Mr. Michael.
Yeah, give a shout-out to Mike.
Mr. Michael, miss you this year?
It's always good to drop a shout-out to the boss, Mr. Mike. Yes, so what do you think your most popular range bags are and why?
I'm going to show you my R2, which is going to be my most popular range bag that I have at the moment. My R2 is the ultimate range bag. It's going to have special compartments for your AR-15 rifle clips, pistol clips, and it's going to hold up to 9 pistols.
Yeah, they're good-looking bags. How can you make so many bags at such an affordable price?
We like to think that we're going to be saving a lot of money on promotional items and on...
Because I'm saying what we do is we also have a couple other bags, mm-hmm. but you look at a Maxpedition bag or something like that, they're very similar,
right.
but they're a third, a fourth of the price. You know, you get a great value from your items.
Technically, you're paying for the name.
Yeah.
You're paying for the name, and you're paying for the advertising they do on magazines, TVs, et cetera, et cetera. We don't go that route. We'd rather save that money that we're going to spend on magazines or on commercials and stuff like that and pass the savings on to the customers.
Yeah, that's a good motto to have. So out of all your bags you have, mm-hmm. What kind of bags do you... I mean, obviously it's audio, so they can't actually
right.
see what I'm seeing. I wish they could. You make great bags. They can always come into our store and view them.
Exactly.
But colorful, all sizes, backpacks, smaller bags. What different kind of varieties do you have, and where could they view those at when they get home online?
No problem. They could go to www.explorebag.com. You're going to find all our style of bags, backpacks, range bags, rifle cases, pouches, and also in the Shooters Club.
Yeah,
they
could
stop
course.
By and check it out.
Well, we appreciate that. And so what kind of variants do you have? I see that there's a ton of different kinds and sizes of bags. What does each... different sizes you go up, try to accommodate.
So we go with your basic range bag, as you can see right here, the R1. That's going to be your beginner's. I would like to say your beginner's range bag. So this bag right here is going to hold up to 3 to 4 pistols, plus your cleaning kit, couple ammos, your, your goggles, your protection, etc. And, I mean, for retail pricing, you look anywhere from $60 to $65.
Yeah, it's very cheap for a
yes.
bag that, for a good duty range bag.
Yeah.
And then you move up, and
we
then what you
up.
Got?
Then we go with our R5.
And they come in a lot of different colors,
oh,
too.
Oh, yes, we do. We have it in OD, tan, and black.
So it'll match the... You got pink, smaller bags in pink, match ladies'
yes,
purses.
Yes, of course. Can't forget the ladies. I mean, ladies' shooting night. We got leopard, pink, zebra, you know, stuff for the ladies as well.
I like that. All right, so then we move up to more of a backpack,
mm-hmm.
and that'll do similar to what your range bag
yes.
would do.
Yes.
But what does it do differently other than it's a backpack?
I mean, we're going to start off with, let's say, like the B3 is the most popular backpack. That's going to be your 24-hour buggo bag. And that's our most popular bag right there. I mean, for retail price, anywhere from $42 to $44.
Yeah, and it looks just like... the bag I got for Christmas that was, unfortunately, it wasn't Explorer, and it was probably $200.
Yes.
That's incredible,
that's
huh?
incredible price. Incredible pricing. But, I mean, your price, you're probably looking at $44 to $40.
Yeah,
a bag.
I think we sell them for about $40.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
So
bug-out bag. Yeah. Everybody needs a bug-out bag.
Exactly. And what else, too? The other backpack right here is going to be our B12, our most popular backpack of all, right here.
That's a big backpack.
Yes, it is. That's what most you're going to be your 72-hour bag right there.
And maybe a daycare. You could probably fit, you know,
you could
small
fit anything,
kid in there.
Anything and everything.
Uh-huh. And then last but not least, we probably sell the most of mm-hmm. your long gun cases, which are very well built and incredibly mm-hmm. inexpensive for what you, you know, what you get.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, all of our bags are made of high quality, really resistant. We made the G37 right here to fit an AR-15.
So most of these, again, our listeners can't see what we're talking about unless they go to our website or come in our store. But
exactly.
It's pretty much a well-built rifle case mm-hmm. that holds five mags
yes,
or more.
Five mags or more.
Uh-huh.
I think it's capable to pick up almost hold up to 400 ammo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it. Well, again, where can they view your products,
at
Mr. Jesse?
www.explorebag.com. You
uh-huh.
can find all our items on the website.
All right, man, and I look forward to selling a ton of them this
yes,
coming
sir.
Year. Thanks
Thank
again,
you
brother.
So much.
I really
and everybody stop
it.
At the Jefferson Indoor Club and pick up our Explorer items at an awesome price.
Man, I got to love that.
Yes.
Free shout-out, Jesse.
Yes.
Way to go.
Yes.
I like it.
Lifetime warranty. Anything happened to your bags, you could contact me at j@explorebag.com as well.
All right, man. Well, thank you. I think we covered all of our bases, and I'll
yes,
see
sir.
You next year.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Mr. Right, Mike,
brother.
I miss you.
Oh, boy, Devin, I tell you what, you just charm these guys, man. Get all that info out of them. Good job on that. What have you brought back to the store now that people can see there at the Jefferson Gun Outlet as far as the Explorer gun bag products?
Oh, man, it's actually incredible. If you come on delivery day, it's Christmas all over again. It's pretty amazing how much stuff we order at the show from Explorer. It took us an hour and a half just to move all the boxes from, you know, off the truck into our storage, our warehouse. It's pretty cool. But anyway, we carry probably 40 different bags, colors, and accessory, you know, holsters. We carry mag pouches. We started carrying those this year. So if you have like a vest that's Molly compatible, or VTAC or something that, you know, that has those little slots in it that you can attach attachments to. We carry pistol mag holders, rifle mag holders. We carry long gun cases, pistol cases, range bags, backpacks, bug out bags. As you heard Jesse say, 72-hour bags, 24-hour bags, single pistol cases, double pistol cases, triple pistol cases, pistol and rifle cases. It goes on, and their colors are real cool. They pop, so it gets customers looking and interested in them a little more. For women, we sell a bunch of those leopard ones, pink ones, cheetah print ones. I mean, they make a ton of a different variety of those small handgun bags, and they're really cheap. The leopard ones, and Gavin sells those at the Shooters Club a lot. I think they start at like $20, $25, you know, for a pink or leopard or zebra bag. So if your girlfriend's getting into shooting and you want to get her something nice, you know, it doesn't cost much. And they're really well made. We've never had a single, you know, complaint or somebody come in and said that it tore or broke or the bottom fell out. You know, it's never happened in 6 years of selling them. They make a really good bag at a really affordable price.
I'm going to have to check out particularly those cheetah pattern. My girlfriend, when she shoots in a bikini, that would match it well. Listen, we've got to take a break, guys. When we come back, I want to use the rest of our time to talk about where is the firearms industry headed now that we've got a Republican-dominated White House and both places in Congress, and also microchipping to control your firearm. I had a guy texted me on yesterday's show, said he did it. Want to find out what that's all about. We're talking guns and coming back right after this. And I'm happy to tell you that our text message board is now operable, and I'm inundated. I'm getting texts now from the last 2 hours. So please text us if you want to ask a question or a comment, 870-870. Gavin and Devin, what are you hearing as far as the future of the firearms industry? Are they anticipating a slowdown now that the nation's leading firearm salesman, Barack Obama, is no longer in office? Are people's fears more calmed about possibility of further tightening restrictions on gun ownership so that might even have a negative impact on the firearms industry? Or how do they feel about it? What did you hear at the shooting, hunting, and outdoor trade show, Devin?
Well, it's nothing negative. Absolutely not. It's a double-edged, you know, double-edged sword, but nothing negative. I want to stress that. So right now, what you can experience, you're looking forward to, me especially, seeing all the new ideas that are going to be pushed. You know, everybody that's manufacturing anything that has to do with firearms is going to start to push that envelope, not to see what they can get away with, but, you know, Republicans rule right now. There's not much in the way of, you know, a worrisome gun economy right now. People are going to start to try to invent things that may push that envelope. We've had three suppressor companies out of Louisiana come into the store in the last 2 months that are just starting, that are making really inexpensive silencers. They're ready for this bill to pass. You know, they're going to start cranking out cans at a really cheap, inexpensive price. They're well built, and a few of them are like none I've ever seen. They have baffles. They also have tubes in them to, you know, I'm not a scientist, but to to suppress that noise, to capture more gas. They're, it's really interesting to see the gun culture evolve, you know, when they feel that everybody's not against them. Mm-hmm. So I would see, I would look forward to seeing firearms that, you know, explore more of the side that hasn't been explored much. You know, they're going to try to get away with a little more because they know they can. You know, they're not, they don't have a president now that's going to shut them down and turn them down and look at them, you know, out of the corner of their eye in the way that they have in the last 8 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Barack Obama sold a ton of guns, and it was good for business, but it wasn't a good time to be a, you know, a gun enthusiast. You were disbarred and looked at in a way that you were, you know, you weren't part of society because you had a gun. It wasn't a good time to be a gun owner or in the gun industry. If you, you know, if you owned a store, you made some money, but that's not really where we want to go with this. You know, we want to get everybody armed in a safe way, in a safe manner, and explore what could be possible now that, you know, you have Republicans on our side. That, you know, they're controlling things now. In the House, Senate, the presidency. So it's very exciting. Nothing bad at all. Yeah, you might not sell quite as many guns as we did in the last 4 or 8 years, but
it does appear to be opening up new horizons for the firearms industry, no doubt. Gavin, from the standpoint of Second Amendment rights, anything down the road, expected changes in legislation that will actually be beneficial to people who believe in their Second Amendment right to carry firearms?
If you listen to everybody that comes in the store since November, they think everything's going to change. I'm going to be the cynical one and tell you that I still don't trust any of them because they're politicians and they're going to do whatever is politically expedient at the moment. I don't care who's in office. I think we're one major event away from, you know, the same kind of sweeping BS that legislation-wise that everybody always proposes. I'm surprised it didn't happen after the guy in the airport a month or so ago. I just don't trust them. I think they're all in that office mostly for their own gain and not really to help us out. I guess I'm being cynical because I live in Louisiana, but I think you need to do the same things you were doing before as far as gun rights. Do everything right. Stop trying to skirt the law. Stop thinking that just because Trump got elected, you can, you know, drink that same Kool-Aid and everything's going to be wonderful. They're going to do whatever's politically good for them right now. 2 years from now, and what, we have Senate elections, I think, 2 years from now, we're one vote away from losing all that advantage and everything else. So they better do the right things now, or you're gonna be back to where you started, no matter who's in that office.
And of course, that Supreme Court nominee is critical. That's for sure.
That's going to be huge, and I think we're going to have more than one Supreme Court nominee. I think on the shooting end, we're busier now than we were before November. I think kind of opposite of them at the store. Has it changed? The only thing that's changed for me, teaching-wise, is that you're now past the people that just want to get a permit, and you're into people who think that they have to have it or they have to buy that gun, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a little bit different. It's harder to deal with at times.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Last item I wanted to discuss. I had a guy yesterday. I was discussing, of all things, human microchipping, which is becoming increasingly popular. And, I mean, they're even selling them now with do-it-yourself kits, and there's legislation going forward to prevent the mandatory use of it. One guy texted me and said that he is microchipped, and he actually controls the use of his firearm by that microchip in his body. In other words, if that firearm is taken from him or stolen, nobody else that is not in possession of that microchip that controls the use of that firearm can use it. How solid a science is that? How effective is that type of stuff?
Wait, what? What are you talking about? Where did you meet this guy? Was he on a street corner?
Look, it's a radio listener who texted me.
Oh,
and said,
okay. I thought.
And we've heard about these, you know, these guns, smart weapons that can only be fired by the owner. And this is one way he said that he operates is with an implanted microchip.
Did you ask him where it is on his body?
No, I didn't want to get that personal with him.
Hmm. I'm very, very curious, Don. I've heard of a lot of stuff, but I've never heard of
Gavin,
that.
You're familiar with smart weapons, right?
I am, but I've never met anybody that chipped themselves and claims they control it. Usually, I don't think the technology for chipped weapons is there yet. They've been doing it since the 70s with magnetic rings and magnets in the gun and stuff like that. The problem is, what if somebody else has to access that gun or you lose the ring or something breaks, et cetera, et cetera. Good Lord, it's just disturbing to me that he, like, chipped himself and, like, he's a dog.
It's becoming more and more popular. There were 10,000 of them sold in Australia as of June 2016. And I had people who, there were, in our opinion poll, I think it ended up somewhere around 20% who said they would consider a microchipping themselves and their kids.
Oh, good God.
What if they short-circuit and the machines take over the world, Don?
Here we go with the Armageddon.
Well, there's a lot of predictions that the computers are going to be so smart that they are going to figure out they no longer need humans and they will take over. That could be the end, you know.
World's moving too fast.
Yeah, well, I've got my hunting dogs are microchipped and a horse is microchipped, for theft or loss purposes. They just put a scan on it and all the information pops up and they're carrying that over to kids and humans. And,
yeah, but see, a veterinarian did that. You didn't just go to, like, Walmart and buy the kit yourself.
There are some do-it-yourself kits, yeah. Now, as far as removing them if you change your mind, I don't know if that's come up yet, but... Yeah, that's kind of where we're headed. So
I just like something to say, if you did microchip yourself, please don't come into Shooters Club and show us exactly where the chip is.
The infected.
From what I understand, they are implanted. They're implanted deep in the chest. From what I understand. Anyway, we got to go on that one. Enjoyed it as always, guys. Look forward to our program next month. Again, Jefferson Gun Outlet. You'll find Devin there, 6719 Airline Drive in Metairie. And also the Shooters Club Indoor Range and Training Center, Gavin Sashery there, 2338 Hickory Avenue in Harahan. Thanks again, guys. Y'all have a happy Mardi Gras.
It's always a pleasure,
too, Don.
Thank you.
All righty. Coming up next, right after the top of the hour news, it'll be Hunt Fish Talk. Lyle Johnson, Wendy Billiott, Keith Lusher join me to talk about the burning issues of the day with regard to the outdoors. And I'm happy to tell you that our text message board, after being inoperable for the past several hours, is now working. So if you care to shoot me a text, it's 870-870. Please, I can't accept photos or videos via that text message board, but it does come in here directly into our studio at St. Hubert's Cathedral. Welcome into another edition of Hunt Fish Talk. Once a month, we have a roundtable discussion of the burning outdoor issues of the day. Joining me is Lyle Johnson, the president of Louisiana Outdoor Writers Association, Wendy Billiott, also known as the Bayou Woman, and Keith Lusher, also a member of Louisiana Outdoor Writers Association and host of the North Shore Fishing Report, which, Keith, next week you will be having a special two-hour edition of that from 7 to 9. So thank you very much for taking that.
Absolutely, Don. Lots to talk about here on the North Shore. Should
yes,
be no
indeed.
Problem taking up 2 hours with that.
And, Wendy, what have you been up to? We missed you last go-around. You had a blessed event in the family, I understand?
Good morning. Yes, I certainly did. Our youngest son got married here at the house, or should I say underneath the house, and it was really, really nice. It turned out very nice, so we're happy about that. Got the youngest pumpkin married off, so.
Well, sounds like your family will be expanding shortly.
Yes,
and Lyle,
my first grandchild coming, too. So.
All right.
Can't wait till
I call you Granny. It'll be Granny
right.
Wendy, huh? Granny Wendy. There's a nice ring to that. The Bayou Grandma. That'll be good. All right. We also have Lyle standing by. Lyle, any comments, my friend?
Oh, well, I've been catching a few brown panfish. It's time of the year for the little baby crawfish to be in the ditches. And I got a few select spots where I can get them every year. And those brim and chickapin just really love those little crawfish. And so I've been having a field day catching those.
Are you experiencing kind of an early spring like most areas?
Oh, yeah. It's been incredible. There's been a guy around here that's selling
tomatoes and cucumbers that he's grown through the winter. So it's been really wild.
Hey, I'm kind of enjoying this global warming, let me tell you, man. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, I did take about a 10-day hiatus from the real early spring and went up to Breckenridge and visited my daughter and a couple grandkids and her husband and got to enjoy some real cold and some snow.
Well, that's very nice. Well, listen, gang, thanks for being with us this morning. A couple issues we're going to take on. The red snapper thing just won't go away. It seems to be the big red elephant in the room, if you will, and kind of divided into two segments. One, it's now we've developed thanks to an investigative reporter in New Orleans television who kind of uncovered something a lot of us have known goes on behind closed doors, and that's the term Sea Kings, the ownership of the commercial quarter of red snapper. We'll get to that a little bit later on. But first, you know, to discuss and update where we are with regard to the management of the red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico, we had a new secretary came in last year, Charles Melancon. He didn't make the whole year before he resigned, and one of the things that got him in big trouble and brought about his resignation was his management or mismanagement of the red snapper issue. Louisiana Congressman Garrett Graves went forward with the legislation trying to take the management of the red snapper from the federal agency, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and divide it up among the five Gulf states, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. Everybody seemed to be going along with it, and all of a sudden, Louisiana, who started the whole program with our Lac Creole system of accounting, which proved that we could do a better job of managing snapper than the feds did, which really didn't take much. I think Bozo the Clown could have done a better job of managing snapper than the feds did. Then all of a sudden, our head of our state agency says, you know, I'm for it, but we can't do it. It's going to cost us way too much. And he kind of turned his back on the other four states and caused them some anxiety, because when the legislature looks at this in Washington and they say, well, wait a minute, let me get this straight. You want to take the management away from feds and give it to the state, but the head guy in the major state of Louisiana is opposed to it and you want us to vote for it? Not going to fly. Well, that being done, he resigned, and we have Mr. Jack Montesette now as our head of the state agency. Governor John Bel Edwards, he kind of took the bull by the horns, and he went before the CCA and gave a speech and said that, yeah, we did give you some mixed messages on the red snapper, but I want to assure you that we are for regional management to take it away from the feds. So that's kind of where it stands now. We're in a state season that is going to go until we reach our quota, which we don't. That's an undetermined amount of time. It kind of depends on the real-time accounting of the snapper quota, and when that quota is reached, we'll shut it down, and that goes out to approximately 9 miles off the Louisiana coast. And, again, we're awaiting the feds to give us another very generous offshore season, which I'm hearing possibly 1 or 2 days with the maximum of maybe the 9 we had last year. Who knows what they're going to give us? I think for all intents and purposes, offshore fishing for red snappers just basically out of the picture. So that being said, Lyle, let's start with you. Where are you on this red snapper thing?
Well, you know, it's a government thing that's, man, you know, I guess y'all all know my somewhat opinion of our government. I'm somewhat of a historian.
Why don't you tell us, Lyle?
Yeah. And, well, I am going to tell you. I read this yesterday. It happened to me, and it's a story out of the Bible, and I'm not going to get spiritual here, but Jesus picked a tax collector for one of his disciples, and he invited Jesus to dinner, and along with many tax collectors and other disreputable sinners, that's what they thought about tax collectors, and the elite people of the day saw it, and they asked his disciples a question, why does he eat with such scum? And so tax collectors have been not well looked upon for all of history, and that's kind of the same opinion I have of our government system. Thomas Jefferson said it was a necessary evil, and it's gotten to where our government, all parts of it, I'm not talking about one side or the other here, I'm talking about the whole shooting mess of it, is way more power than they ever were supposed to have according to our Constitution. And so most everything today is an overreach of power by government because of the money involved. And so it's no different than anything else that's going on in our country right now as far as there's way too much money involved in everything, and the government has way too much power, and they get their hands in everything, and it's overreach because, you know, the average guy that fishes for a red snapper, you know, he has a little bit of money. He may even, or she may even donate a little bit of it to political candidates and what have you. But the snapper barons is the one that's got all the money, and they are very free about donating it to politicians that are going to keep them in the loop. And I don't know if y'all discussed this, but, you know, they pretty much got rid of a House of Representatives member in Florida for that very reason, and they were very truthful and forthcoming about it. It was a plan they hatched, and they got rid of him, and by donating a lot of money to his opponent. And so it's pretty much out of control as far as the government overreach. I mean, there's no way they can reconcile their data with what actually goes on out there, not just the fact that they use flawed data to assess the stock population, but to assess the catch ratio as well. It's impossible for a recreational fisherman to catch what they say they catch in the limited amount of time they have.
Mm-hmm. Wendy, I aired on my website the entire speech that Governor John Bel Edwards made at the CCA meeting, and one of the things that I picked up on out of it was he suggested, didn't recommend or said they were going forward, but said it might be good to consider a tagging program similar to what we have for alligators or deer and turkeys, where Wendy Billiott would be issued X amount of red snapper tags, and she can go catch them anytime, anywhere she wants in the Gulf, and, you know, everybody will be happy with their amount of tags.
Well,
would
you know,
be supportive of that? Would you be happy
well,
with that?
My first reaction to that is, and this is just an off-the-cuff reaction, is that they sure better start looking for the loopholes now, because I'm not going fish red snapper, and I just might turn around and sell those tags. So they better start looking for the loopholes now in any other alternative system, because this IFQ has so many loopholes. And to hear Garrett complaining about sea lords and, you know, all of that, it drives me insane, because it's like they're not doing anything illegal. The thing is, nobody foresaw all these loopholes. Nobody foresaw them leasing out their fish or outright selling their permits. I mean, nobody anticipated any of that. But if you find the document, some Gulf Alliance group came up with all these alternatives. Did you see that? It was a research paper. And the fish tag system is one of the alternatives. And they list the pros and the cons. And honestly, the cons outweigh the pros for me. So I honestly think that the governor just kind of had someone did a little bit of homework and said, give them something. So tell them you're thinking about doing the fish tag system.
Well, I got blamed for it. Immediately after that program, CCA contacted me and said that their members said that I said that we should have a red snapper tagging program, and I was simply the messenger quoting what Governor John Bel Edwards said he might consider. So people are they're waiting. The hammers are cocked and the safeties are off, and I don't think it's going to be welcome too much. Keith, what do you think about tagging system for red snapper?
I think it's too much, honestly. Why can't we just get to a system like we have for just most fish? It just seems like this is just getting way out of hand, and it all started with basically money and power, you know, like, you know, Melanson getting in there. And, you know, what I find was very weird, how he said they couldn't afford this and, you know, there was not enough funding. And at the same time, he announces that they're going to bring back, what was it? What's the magazine called?
Louisiana Conservation.
Louisiana Conservation. And they're going to bring that back. Now, that was a failing magazine. Then he announces there's going to be no ads in it, which means it's going to fail even more. So how can, at the same time you say that, you're not going to have enough money? That was clearly an excuse. They were clearly bought off. But getting back to the trying to restore. I mean, it's already restored. You got guys going out there saying that's all they can catch now is red snapper. So something's definitely out of whack. And as far as tagging, it just seems like it's just too much. Why can't we just get down to a normal quota of what other fish are monitored by, you know?
I think Lyle and Wendy hit on it. Money, generally in any issue, if you follow the money trail, it's going to lead you to the answer. It's going to lead you to the truth. And
we'll
come back from this break. I want to pick up and talk more about the Fox 8 out of New Orleans investigation into the Sea Lords, Red Snapper Barons, whatever you want to call them, and let people know what that situation is all about and ask if the big question is that's what's driving both the commercial and the recreational allocations of red snapper. We'll be right back. You're listening to Hunt Fish Talk. Don Dubuque, Lyle Johnson, Wendy Billiott, and Keith Lusher, and you, the listener, right here on WLFM 105.3 HD. And welcome back into the Hunt Fish Talk program. We are talking snapper, red snapper management, mismanagement. Guys, I want to move on to the commercial aspect of this. It's something that I've known and a lot of people have known for a long time, but it's kind of been a dirty little secret. It was exposed by a New Orleans television station, an investigative report series, and that's dealing with the Sea Kings, Red Snapper Barons. There's a lot of names for them. And what has happened is a public resource, the Red Snapper, the commercial quota allocation, 81% of it is owned by a total of 52 people. It's extremely lucrative. The people that own these poundage quotas, they actually can sell them. Most of them no longer fish themselves. They sell their quotas to individual fishermen who then bear the brunt of the expense of a boat, equipment, personnel, ice, actually going out and doing the work and then coming in and selling the fish. They have to pay the snapper baron for the quota, and then they use their quota to catch fish, and there they have an expense, so they're not making near the money. But the Sea Kings, the snapper barons, are making millions with a public resource. They say they deserve it because they did nothing wrong. They used their typical catch records that they used, and they were assigned these quotas, which goes back several years. Other people argue that, no, this is a public resource, and for them to be able to capitalize on and make this kind of money, which in turn there are rumors and allegations that that money is being used to control politics, to keep it the way it is, and to prevent the recreational fishermen from capitalizing on the abundance that we now see in red snapper. One of the potential solutions, an argument I got from someone who owns part of that quota, was, well, why don't you just get the government to buy us out, buy our quotas, and then distribute that to the recreational fishermen? Lau, you see any other solution, or what do you think about that solution? I mean, that would be extremely costly, especially if they're looking for 3 years down the road of an estimated cost of what their buyout would be.
Yeah, it's astronomical. I don't think that's a very workable solution. It reminds me, and I was just thinking about this during the break, I'm going to confess, I watch some reality shows, and one of them is Bering Sea Gold. And a lot of people still mine gold in Alaska. I love Alaska shows, been there a few times, you have as well. And so all of the land is no different than red snapper allocation thing. All of the land is claimed. In other words, you can hardly find any land to stake a claim in Alaska to mine gold. And so what they do is they find the people that own the claims, and then they strike a deal with them, and, hey, I'll give you 20% of whatever gold I find, or whatever percentage they agree to. And I don't know how you go about fixing that unless you just, you know, it started off everybody out there fishing. I can remember fishing with a offshore captain at one time, and it's not Doc Kennedy, and we had, man, about 500 pounds of snapper on the boat back in the time when you didn't catch snapper like that very often. And he agreed to let us not pay him if we just left the fish on his boat, which we did not do because we wanted the snapper. But, you know, it started off just a small thing, you know, commercial thing. And eventually, because of business and whatever, comes to the place where we are today, where a few people they've staked their claim in the snapper business, and it's a few of them. And rather than go through the expense of buying everything you have to do to and insurance and all that, it's just so much easier to let somebody else do it, and you take a percentage of it. And other than a strong reformation, I just have no idea how we're going to fix that because there's too much money involved in it.
Well, not only that, but it gets worse because it seems that these quotas can be passed down from family member to family member. So there's no way for the public or someone interested in getting into the commercial snapper business to even get a foothold in it. Wendy, what do you think about this situation that we're in? Is it something that they have earned and deserve, or is there a solution other than buying them out to kind of breaking that up?
Well, as I mentioned before, I don't think that anyone foresaw, and that fellow Bob Shipp, who was, I don't know, was he a nymph or whatever when the IFQs were handed out in 2007, they just didn't think about all the things that could happen. And it's like a sublease. You know, if you have a place and you're not doing anything with it, and you lease it to me for $100, and I turn around, you know, $100 a month, and I turn around and lease it to someone for $1,000 a month, I'm making $900. Well, that, you know, the guy I'm leasing from can say, hey, that's not fair. Well, you know what? Welcome to America and American enterprise and capitalism, because this is our system. This is how it works. As far as a buyout, I think that's ridiculous. Are we talking about a total buyout? Are we talking about buying the little guys, the guys who have the lease shares? I mean, how many pounds of recreational snapper can we – how many pounds of snapper can our recreational guys catch? You see, to me, that buyout, that's ridiculous. I mean, and Lyle talked about flawed data. How in the world do we know how many fish recreational fishermen can catch? Or are we just saying there will be more recreational fishermen?
Don, just out of curiosity, I'm sorry, Wendy. Where does HR 3094 stand? Is that totally gone, or do you have any information?
No, it's still alive. It's still alive, and a lot of people believe that one of the underlying things that's driving 3094 is to break up the red snapper baron issue, and that's why there is a lot of opposition, and there's even some suspicion that that's what got into Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries through the person who became the spokesman and the figurehead in Charles Melanson. If you trace it all back, it goes back to prevention of breaking up the snapper barons. That is, you know, and there's so much money in it, it's certainly possible.
Well, let me finish in saying that We have to go back to history. We have to go back, and whenever we began, or whoever began issuing permits for these guys to catch red snapper, you know, it was the guys who wanted to catch red snapper that went out and invested all the money in the boats and everything. Those are your sea lords now, but, you know, back before 2007, back historically, they're the ones who made the investments, or their father or their grandfather at this point might have made the investments. Now, they may have fished it through the years, and now they may be sitting back being called armchair fishermen. But there was nothing in that system that disallowed any of that. So, again, you know, for us to be bad-mouthing the sea lords and saying, you know, it's not fair, it's not fair. What's not fair about it? This is how it was done. They're only taking advantage. And what I keep hearing Garrett Graves saying over and over is, and no one's pointed this out, is that the government isn't getting anything in return for this public resource. These fish are a public resource. Well, yes, they are. They're paying income taxes. They're paying sales taxes. And I saw something in a letter from one organization to Lee Zurich that said they pay 3% every year of their gross catch back to keep the program going. So that's my two cents.
Keith?
Yeah, I agree with Wendy. But as she said, the government is not getting any money. Well, that's on one level, but on another level it is. I mean, there's money coming in, whether it's to the campaigns of you know, like Melanson or Bell Edwards. I mean, look at this Steve Tomney guy of Fort Pouchon, you know, maxed out donation to John Bell Edwards. I'm guessing he just didn't like his politics. There was a reason why he did that. So to say they're not making money or, you know, not cashing in any kind of way, that's a different level as what I'm seeing here. And I'm curious to know is if this investigation didn't happen and wasn't brought to the public on TV, would we still be going through what we're going through now? Like, did this investigation push, you know, Edwards to come up and change his stance on this?
Well, I'm not sure. I believe his speech, you know, might have been in advance of the breaking of the story. But, I mean, it was all known that it was going to come out. You know, I have a little bit of a different take on it. I've always had a problem with people making a living off of a public resource. Certainly, I believe that someone should be paid to go out and harvest it in the case of crabs and oysters and shrimp and fin fish, certainly. But the ownership of that public resource is different. That's different. To go out and harvest it under the regulations that are allowed, that's one thing. You can, if you took it on a state level, let's suppose we decided to take all of the crabbers and give them ownership of the crabs that we as taxpayers and proponents of wildlife and fisheries, we funded and other sources that fund it. We have managed it. We've brought it to where it is at public expense for the gain of private individuals, and I would have a real problem with that. And I think that's the case with this red snapper. It's a public resource. And they certainly have the right to be paid to go out and harvest it, to provide it as to the public for consumption. But to actually take ownership of a resource, I don't know. I got a problem with that. Anyway, I think we'll leave the snapper issue for another day. We're certainly going to be talking about it after this break. We come back. I want to talk about the second issue on the board, and that is that of private versus public wetlands and waterways. And if you think red snappers, Harry, this one even more complex. We'll be back to try to make some sense out of it. You're listening to Hunt Fish Talk. Keith Lusher, Wendy Billiott, Lyle Johnson. I'm Don Dubuque. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back. Come back in to Hunt Fish Talk. We're now going to talk and discuss the private versus public wetlands and waterways issue. We have discussed this before, and as you know, Captain Darryl Carpenter, past president of Louisiana Charter Boat Association, has decided to go forward with a 36-page lawsuit. In the suit are named several entities, most of them Lafourche Parish authorities, the sheriff's office, and some of the employees there. Also, the company that has hired the sheriff's office to enforce keeping people off of what some people consider to be public waterways and they consider to be private, therein lies the rub. I think that this lawsuit could be one of precedent setting, depending on how it turns out. I spoke with the two attorneys that are going forward with it, and they assured me that they're very optimistic that they will win this case. They said they have gone to court 12 times, and they have been successful 12 out of 12 times in representing plaintiffs who said that they have been violated and experienced economic losses because of being kept out of waterways, which should be deemed open to the public but are enforced as private. So that's where it lies right now. And, Wendy, start with you. I don't know how bad of a problem this is in your area. You're down there around the Dulage area. In some areas, it's not much of a problem, but in that part of the state, from Leeville, Golden Meadow, Myrtle Grove, it's spreading over towards the Lafitte area, out west towards Calcasieu. Landowners are starting to flex their muscles and hiring law enforcement authorities to patrol those areas, staking a claim saying these are not public waterways, they're owned by private entities, you need to pay us a fee to get in or we want to keep you out. Up until this point, for the most part, boaters and fishermen have just accepted being run off and said, I'll go somewhere else rather than fight it. But now we're starting to see more and more people draw the line, not in the sand, but in the wetlands and say, I ain't running no more. I'm going to fight this and take it to court. What has been your experience, Wendy?
Well, are we still talking about water land that has turned to shallow bays? Or
we're talking about all of it. Canals, natural waterways, yeah, anything that people are starting to put signs up and even don't have signs up and say they don't need signs. And by some process of osmosis or psychic, we should be able to know that this is
private. Well, my understanding is they don't have to have signs. And my other understanding is that the onus is on the boater to know whether or not he's trespassing. Now, they can check that law, but that's my understanding. And whether it's a shallow bay or a canal, and yes, we have a problem over here. There's a big corporation between where I live, going to the east, between here and the Home of Navigation, or by Grand Cayou. And this corporation is known as a land company. They own lots of it out here. And while there are no gates on this maze of canals that run through all those wetlands they own, they sell a pass for $75 a year. They'll let you trespass and fish. Now, there are no gates to keep anyone out. You go in there, they haven't called the sheriff's department on anybody, but they have a guy that rides around, and he will run you out. And I guess if you trespass repetitively, and they do have signs everywhere marking that this is private property, and if you do repetitively pass, I would assume that if you got arrested, it would be more than just a criminal trespass. It becomes felonious at some point when you continue to do it and know you're doing it. And I probably shouldn't say this, but can you tell me that a charter fisherman who's fishing where he's been most of his life doesn't know that he's trespassing?
Well, now what they're calling...
Maybe this was done to shine a light on it so that there could be a lawsuit, that this could go down.
All right. Are you telling me that this land corporation is claiming that navigable waters, open bays, that have no gates, have no blockage, it's not landlocked, that you can get into it in a boat, that they legally can prevent someone from going in there who does not step on solid ground or soggy ground? They stay in their boat and they're fishing for public resources in the water between the surface and the water bottom, that they have a legal right to keep that person out or to charge them to go in?
Yes, they can. It runs along a bayou. It's a big, huge segment of land and wetlands. But as you know here, we've got rig canals everywhere. And the way you cut a rig canal is you start at the bayou and cut into the marsh. So there are series of little natural tornasses and bayous, but there are also rig canals all through that property. And if any of them adjoin the bayou, people can just go in there, and people have been run off. I've talked to people, and I know people who have the pass, who pay the $75 for the privilege to go fish in there.
Well, has it
been
tested in court?
Years.
Has anybody tested in court to find out if it is, in fact, legally private water?
That I'm aware of, no. And on the other side of this, I'm in on a lease, and we just got finished having to fix our gate again. It was torn down again to the point that people, and this is a duck hunting lease, that people could go around the gate and go in there and go fishing. And what is it about human nature that you think that we're just holding something in there? You think that we're holding the redfish in there? No, they can swim under the gate. They can come and go as they want, like you say, with the ebb and the flow. But that's just human nature. I think they got something in there that I want. But my question is, are there not enough public waters for everybody to fish public waters and not worry about trespassing?
All right, duck season, I think, is a very special case. Is that gate locked and access denied outside of the duck season?
Yes, that gate is locked year-round.
Okay, and for what purpose would people be kept? But you're leasing it for duck rights.
Well, but there's also deer hunting, and we fish it.
See, that's where the problems come in, you know. That's the problem. Lyle, what are you – you've been quiet back there. Go ahead and talk.
Well, about 15 years or so ago, probably 20 years ago, the first issue with chaffly basin crawfishermen. They begin to, landowners begin to say, hey, man, you can't come in here anymore. We're going to charge you because this is normally dry land. And so I did some research on it, and the Louisiana state law was very plain, much to my chagrin in one area. And it stated very plainly, private canals dug with private money, and we're talking about water bottoms here, shall remain private. So that pretty much kind of give somebody the right, if they want to gate and post a privately dug canal. All navigable waterways, natural waterways, water bottoms do not belong to the landowner up to the normal high tide limit. And then there was a couple of cases where some people got prosecuted because they were able to go from the Mississippi River to a private piece of property because the water got high in the Mississippi River. And it's kind of went downhill since. Somewhere along the line, somebody changed the law because the law stated very plainly, water bottoms do not belong to private landowners if it's a natural, navigable waterway. Of course, I personally believe, I hope Wendy don't get mad at me, but anywhere you can float, you can fish or go. I mean, Louisiana is the only state in the whole United States that has coastal waterways that has these kind of laws. And a couple years ago, if y'all remember, we did a show on the lack of the drop in hunting and fishing licenses in Louisiana, in the United States since the 1950s, and hunting was astronomical. Fishing was not so bad in Louisiana. Actually, was on the increase a little bit because of the amount of public waterways. But those waterways, man, it's already up here in the freshwater. Lake Burette area is really gotten terribly bad. Regular, navigable, natural waterways are now having gates and post signs on them. And fishing is going to go the way of hunting. Pretty soon it's going to be so exclusive, the average Joe is not going to be able to hunt all fish. We're going to be like the serfs were back in England. Probably not going to happen in our lifetime, but only the private landowners are the ones that are going to be able to take fishing game from waterways.
Sure hope you're wrong on that one, Lyle, but I got to agree with you. It appears that it could be headed that way. Listen, we got to take a break. We come back. Keith, I'm going to get you to weigh in on this issue, private versus public wetlands, waterways. Where are we on it, and what can be done to deal with it? It's become a problem. There's confrontations taking place. We now have some serious lawsuits being filed. Where will it all end up? We'll be right back. It's Hunt Fish Talk on WWL FM 105.38.
Hey, guys, it's time to gear up. Spring is right around the corner, so dust off that tackle box and head on over to Bayou Adventure and fill it up with all the right stuff. Our coffee is hot, our beer is cold, and the fish stories, well, they're stories. But what's not a story is our live bait. Shiners, crickets, worms are available daily. We're also a full-service convenience store, tackle store, and hobby shop. So come check out that drone you've been thinking about. 10 minutes from Mandeville, 10 minutes from Slidell, on the highway in Lacombe, Bayou Adventure. Yeah, we do that. 7 days a week.
And we're talking about private versus public waterways and wetlands. And, Keith, you know, I did a show on this on the Friday show, and, God, it was just so much input from the listeners through text and phone calls. And I had a phone call from a man from Missouri who happened to be listening and said he came here regularly and was kind of incensed about what was going on. He said, you know, he had all this advertisement out of state to come to Louisiana, enjoy the resources, the fishing and the food. Came down here and he felt like he kind of got kicked in the teeth when the guide he was with was told to leave the area in a not-so-pleasant manner. Another instance named in that lawsuit, there was a 72- or 74-year-old woman that brought her grandchild with her. They were out fishing with Daryl Carpenter and had a very unpleasant experience when law enforcement people came out and they were told to leave and kind of upset them. So what are we doing to our tourism industry with this kind of a rule in place? And generally, what are your thoughts on it, Keith?
Well, I mean, this is Louisiana living up to its name of, you know, being a good old boy state. You know, Florida does not have this problem. It's plain written law that, you know, basically you're floating navigable waters. If you can get to it, you know, that's public. And they don't seem to bend on that. And I think that's where we're in trouble is where, you know, if you own land on both sides of the water, we've owned land on both sides of the water in Lafitte. And not one time that we think about crossing it off. We've had fishermen come through there fishing. We fished it. But now I think about it, and when you pose the question of, well, if you could do it, would you do it? And I think that's where the hang up is if you can gate that off and that can become yours, man, what a great asset that would be, you know? So I just think that it's just, everything is just getting a little out of hand here with this lawsuit, let's just say this, this lawsuit's either going to make or break it. If this can go through and we can get a bearing on where this is going, it's either going to improve everything or it's going to make it worse, because if private land is now dictating private waters, which seems insane. I don't know what private water is, because, I mean, if I'm fishing on the outside of a gate and the tide's coming out, now that's your water that was in there. Now it's on me. Now, is that public now? Or, I mean, if I catch a redfish and it swims under the gate, is that now a private redfish? It's just insane. It's getting out of hand. And I just hope we can get some clarity from this lawsuit brought about.
Well, let me ask a question. If the lease I'm talking about is a hunting club, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I pay to be in that every year. It is land. It's held by a land owner. It happens to be off of a rig canal that is private. And mm-hmm. that rig canal was dug by a company. That company also owns all that land that's out there. And so we drive that private canal to get in our lease, but we pay for the privilege to be in this hunting club. How is this any different when somebody breaks down our gate? So now we're talking criminal, okay? How is it any different from me trespassing on somebody's deer hunting lease? What's the difference?
Well, that's different, because that is now. I mean, that's established. That's private. A private canal that was dug, that is definitely private. So you're definitely in the right to do
so this
that.
This is a very complex issue, because
right.
People are griping about not being able to go in a canal. Well, they have to post that for liability, because Florida, that's apples and oranges. Does Florida have all the wellheads and sunken pilings and sunken ships and stuff that we have around here that make these waters really not safe to navigate?
Well, that's a good point, Wendy, and certainly I would think for the interest of safety, if there's equipment or obstructions in a canal and it's deemed as being one that could be hazardous, they certainly would have the right for self-protection from lawsuits and accidents to gate it off and keep it gated off. But the question on that canal, was that at one point a natural waterway that was dug to widen it and deepen it, or was it just solid land that they put a canal in?
Mm-hmm. They dug into the marsh. It's a company canal, for an inland barge, for an inland drilling barge. There are 3 or 4 wellheads back there.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, that should be a private canal, and the public should be denied access through it. Now, as far as the wetlands where the duck hunting takes place, I think that's a gray area, and I would think for duck leases, they would have to apply the same principle they do on the state, the national wildlife refuges. You can't go in there and fish during a 60-day period, and actually I think it's a little broader than that, when waterfowl are present. You just can't go in there, and that's a federal law. And for duck leases, I would put in the same stipulation that during duck season, it's at the most it's going to be a 60-day season. Fishermen should not be allowed to go in there. Now, in your case, they're not accessed through a private canal, so unless there's another way for them to get in there to go fish it, they would only be able to be allowed to do that outside of the waterfowl season. Then I think they probably would have a right to do it if it's navigable natural waterways leading into water and they don't get out of a boat and they don't set foot on land.
Well, I think we need to go to the basics. What is navigable? If you look it up, it's deep enough and wide enough for a ship to pass through, and navigable waters are charted. All of the obstructions in these what are now shallow bays that used to be maybe land, all of that stuff is not charted. We're talking danger and liability here, and there's no doubt in my mind that the companies that own this land that's gone to water now and is shallow bays, they are most certainly concerned about liability. And you'll never change my mind on that.
Wow.
It's not charted. If you look at a true chart of navigable waters, everything is marked when it's a navigable water. Buoys, obstructions, ships, anything. A hazard navigation is marked.
Okay, then how does the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries come into all of this? If there's going to be so much private water, are you keeping them out? I mean, how are they gonna do their job as far as maintaining, you know, the limits, the laws? How's that work?
Let me ask you a question. Can a policeman go into a gated community to do his job? To me, it's the same thing. I wouldn't see anybody keeping the wildlife and fisheries out from doing their job.
Well, you know, but on another part of that, I think that the term navigable could be challenged. If you look at other states, what they consider navigable waters as all open to the public is certainly not requiring that a ship be able to get in there. Now, we have got a very special problem here, and we can thank our ancestors for doing that by putting in Napoleonic law where waterways were, wetlands were considered as private land because other states don't have to deal with that. And somewhere, I believe, in between, you know, the illegal posting of public waterways and maintaining what is private, because if you were to try to go for the gold and change it to get what Florida has, you'd come under the takings laws, and there's no way we would ever be able to afford to buy out all the people's private property and turn it over to public. There's just no way that that would ever happen because there's not enough money to do that.
Well, that's my question. Where is this going? What is the end goal?
The end goal is to allow the public to access a public resource so long as they don't trespass onto somebody's wet land or into a private canal, which is a legal private canal, which was dug with private funds at private expense and was not a public waterway, which was simply expand it to be a larger size. It's very technical, and we're not going to solve it in the next 4 minutes, I can tell you that, and it's going to go on and on. But, you know, the main thing is to get it going and get something proceeding to where we're going to stop these on-water confrontations, because there's already been some injuries sustained from confrontations, and it's just a heartbeat away from a fatality coming about doing this thing. I can
see
it coming.
Well, Don, we said this in the show last year. This is not the landowner's fault. And this is not the lessee's fault, and we need to be respectful of people. We've never run anybody out of the canal. People fish up and down the canals all the time, and Lyle knows it. Not Lyle's probably fished it.
I've fished the Child Gate many times.
Okay.
But
this
I'm not trespassing.
Lyle broke the gate.
No, I did not.
Well, we don't run people out of there, okay?
Right.
And
look,
and we don't appreciate you tearing the gate down. So that you can, you know, go in. I mean, that's
well, I'll get a crew and go fix that gate. Go
patch it up, man. It's done now for the third
look,
time.
Look, at this point in time, my beef is not with the private canal, not your canal, Wendy. Where they stepped over the line from that old law, they are now posting and making people and enforcing trespass laws on a natural waterway, not navigable. Navigable is part of the conversation, but I'm talking about that law that we have on the books that was a natural waterway that was not dug with private funds, or even like where I live, the Virgin Canal. It's a canal.
Can you give an example of someone doing that law?
Well, sure.
Okay.
It's in Lake Merritt. It's rampant.
Yeah. Okay, right. Right. I had a feeling it's what you were talking about.
And then,
yeah, I mean, look at that canal that Troy Landry, was that privately dug? That is, when I saw a picture of that is a massive gate. That is a massive canal.
Yeah, well, the Troy Landry thing is a little bit different. That, you know, if they would just post privately dug canals, that would, and leave all the natural waterways alone, then that would be a compromise I think a lot of people could live with.
That probably would solve a large percentage of the problems, but as of right now, they're taking not having to post hard land in North Louisiana on dry land into the wetlands, and it just doesn't work. Guys, the music is playing. We got to go. Enjoyed it as always. Great show, Wendy, Keith, and I'll look forward to the next one.
Thanks, guys.
See y'all.
All right, Keith. And we'll look forward to Keith's 2-hour North Shore Fishing Report edition from 7 to 9 on More Outdoors next Saturday morning, so be sure and be tuned in. And I'll see you again back at 5 a.m. next Saturday morning for the Outdoors with Don Dubuque Radio Network. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.